Hey, hi, this is Greg Kelly. Welcome back to the podcast. Before we get to our guest today, I am going to give a little teaser about what I'm working on right now. It's a side project, a side hustle, but I'm very, very excited about the results so far. I'm getting ripped. I'm not ripped yet, but I can tell. It's taking shape. There's a ripped person inside of me, and slowly I'm getting closer and closer to that individual. A couple of pretty simple, common sense things I'm doing about diet and exercise, and the results so far have been very, very encouraging. I think the community will be impressed at the appropriate time. In the meantime, in America, we are having a very silly conversation about race. It's a silly conversation to avoid having an important, serious conversation, a consequential conversation. I am pleased today to be joined by Kenny Hsu. Kenny is helping to lead an important, substantive conversation about race in America. Most recently, he is the author of An Inconvenient Minority, The Attack on Asian American Excellence and the Fight for Meritocracy. He is also the president of an organization called Color Us United, which seeks to, have a country where we are judged based on our character, not on our outside, our exterior. And I think that is an incredibly noble pursuit. He also happens to be a Christian, and we'll speak about that. Very bright, very articulate, very thoughtful young man. Since you won't be able to see him, I am going to point out now that he is he's Asian American. And that's very relevant to our conversation. He's been on Newsmax a bunch, and you probably have seen him throughout the media. If you haven't, you will in the future. I think he's got an incredible future. Very, very big. An important guy to know, and I'm glad I got to know him a little bit. You will, too, in a moment. My conversation with Kenny Hsu. I just want to start with something that's fresh on my mind. Eric Adams is the new mayor of New York City. I've known of this guy for about 25 years. He's absolutely terrible in every respect. No integrity, no ability, really checkered past. But the media here in New York gave him an absolute free pass and free ride. And they picked on and harassed Andrew Yang every step of the way. And one of the reasons I became a real Yang fan was during the, I thought he was great during the campaign, although not necessarily, you know, I was going to vote for him, but I thought he did a great job against Biden. Anyway, he had the temerity to call out this guy's lack of anything, lack of ability, lack of integrity, all those things that I just went through. And he did it publicly. And I just thought it was an amazing episode. I've not seen that kind of political bravery in a long, long time. Do you have any thoughts on Yang, and do you know what I'm talking about regarding the mayor's race?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I followed the mayor's race, and I actually am familiar with Yang, obviously. Andrew Yang, he's a really interesting guy. He, I think, has the right heart and the right ideas, but as a strategist of politics, he has a lot to work on. If you guys remember, he was the leader, the front runner in the New York mayoral race for a while before Eric Adams eventually overtook him. And you don't lose front runner status unless the way that you campaign is somehow lacking. And he did give this impression to a lot of New Yorkers that he was sort of aloof from their concerns, including his tweet that he was, over in Westchester instead of actually in the city during the coronavirus pandemic. And so what Eric Adams won eventually was that he was able to feel in touch with the New Yorkers. That did not mean that he had the best ideas. It didn't mean that he is the best person. In fact, we know that a lot of the cops that Eric Adams worked with really didn't like Eric Adams. But Yang, I think he's a person who needs to develop into a better candidate. I don't really know what he's doing right now. He's launching the Forward Party or something like that. I don't really, I'm obviously if it works out, I'll look like a fool, but I'm pretty skeptical that it works out. I think that if he were to make a major switch, he should have switched the Republican Party, because it's clear that the Democratic Party does not have a place for the kinds of ideas that he was testing in the public sphere.
Well, that's a great analysis. And also, as a practitioner of politics, I saw that he kind of wore his feelings a little bit too openly. Like when he was, he started to lose, and he just lost all enthusiasm for the race. But just
Right.
based on his resume, I thought he was, head and shoulders above anybody else. And then the other thing is, oh, and social media—the fallacy of social media. I mean, he was. You can let that fool yourself into thinking that you're making headway on the ground, and it wasn't that kind of a race. But I just because I just saw Eric Adams on TV, and he's kind of getting away with murder. I mean, literally, it drives me crazy. So do me a favor. How did you come up with the name Inconvenient Minority?
I was struggling with the book title for a long time because the book wasn't really fully done. And at the time, I was selling my book concept, which was supposed initially, I pitched my book as an examination of the Harvard discrimination case against Asian Americans, and its lasting consequences. And over time, actually, my agent and I, we talked with a number of different publishers. And one of the publishers that actually we did not eventually sign with, but one of the publishers did suggest to us, hey, this is, it's crazy how the Asians work. It's like, they're a minority, but they don't get the privileges of being a minority. They must be really inconvenient to the narrative. And then I just started thinking in my head, huh, Asians are pretty inconvenient to the narrative. Maybe they're the inconvenient minority. And so that's how it sort of dawned on me. My agent was like, yes, that's the title right there. And so that's how we came up with it. And since then, it's really spawned a lot of interest in the subject of Asian Americans, which I think is really good for this country, because ultimately you have to understand a lot of the trends that we're seeing about the various inequities in this country, everything like that, is not necessarily because a person is a minority or a person is white, but because of the cultural values that you have to pay attention to culture. Asian Americans should not have a right, by no rights, should be in pole position in terms of household income and educational attainment, but they do simply because they study twice as many hours as the average American and have two parent family structures. So that's why they are inconvenient, because they're inconvenient to the left's narrative that your race and your background determine who you are.
The left would also have us believe that a white supremacy, a white supremacist, would be opposed to people of color, whether they be Asian or black, and come up with, well, just be opposed to them, and somehow that could actually hold back an entire community. And I assume you find that to be ridiculous.
Well, it is ridiculous, and Asian Americans show why that's the case. Because think about America being a white supremacist country. A white supremacist country is a country supposedly that is supposed to be structured such that, whites are at the top and erase the gains of minorities. But then you see this minority, Asian Americans, who basically come here with basically no money and no wealth and no social connections. And within one generation, they're able to succeed in this country. They're actually able to have higher incomes, higher educational attainment than even whites. Asian males have the highest, is the highest race gender combination in terms of average personal income. That doesn't mean there aren't problems with Asian Americans. Don't get me wrong. Asian Americans, I think, suffer from a lot of deleterious effects of not being well positioned in the political and cultural scene. Don't get me wrong about that. And I think the Harvard case actually kind of shows that. But at the very least, you have to say, hey, wait, well, the U.S. can't be necessarily just a white supremacist country if they're allowing this minority to get ahead of them. That doesn't make any sense. And in reality, the truth is that the U.S. is not a white supremacist country. The U.S. is structured meritocratically, at least the bottom 80% of America, I think, is structured meritocratically, whereby if you do, you know, three of three things, if you have a full-time job, if you get married before you have children, and you don't have a criminal record, you are 99% chance of not being in poverty in this country. And that's been true for a while now, and that's been true across all of the races. This is still a country that is structured based on cultural values.
First of all, when we're talking about Asian Americans, can you just define that? Who are we actually talking about?
So when we're talking about Asian Americans, we're talking about Americans that have origins in the continent of Asia. Now, I know it's a huge continent, and people say, well, how could you make such general statements about Asian Americans? And I've studied a lot of different Asian American groups. I've studied Chinese, Japanese. I've studied Viet, studied Filipino Asian Americans. And all of them come with different blends. I've studied Indian Americans. All of them come with different blends of cultures and values in this country. But there are two conclusions that I can draw as a whole. All of them, at least the ones who come to America, value education, and all of them have some sort of experience, oppressed experience relating to communism, because of how pervasive it was in Asia. So the story that I can spin from those two generalizations, I think it's a story of culture, and it's a story of escaping from some of the worst forms of identity politics that the world has ever seen, and why they are so passionate at defeating the resurgence of that in America.
What about the term, and forgive me, it's BIPAC, what is it? Asian Indigenous Pacific Islanders or something. What is it called?
Oh, Asian American Pacific Islander.
Now, which is APAC, right?
No.
How do you say that?
AAPI.
Is that, just tell me, like, you don't use that term. Some folks do, or maybe you do. Is there any distinction that needs to be made there? I guess Pacific Islanders is not there. It's obviously not on the Asian continent. Anyway, it seems to me like it's a new politically correct phrase. I'm not sure. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, the origins of it. API is a census term. That's it. All it is a census categorization, because they had no idea where to put in the Americans that came from like Pacific Islander countries. So they just say, okay, you guys are Asian now. Okay, fine. It's like saying everybody from Mexico to Argentina are Hispanic or Latino. You know, that's a political categorization. The term Asian American is funny. It's interesting. That came from a group of Marxists at Berkeley in 1960. Like, you can directly trace the origins of that grouping, because they were worried that people who looked like them wouldn't have a political voice unless they organized into a cohesive identity that was stronger than just the country origin. If you think about, you know, Chinese Americans versus Japanese Americans, I mean, a lot of them hate each other, or a lot of Chinese hate the Japanese, and a lot of Japanese hate the Chinese for obvious reasons. But they're lumped into the same category in the United States. So I would, you know, hesitate to, I would hesitate to, you know, assume that there's much more generalities that can be arranged except for the ones that I gave.
You said there are two features that Asian Americans bring with them. Number one, education. Now, where does that come from? in the culture. And you mentioned that it's, you know, whether it's Filipino or Chinese, they value education. Why is that?
I think it comes from Confucianism. I think it comes from a longstanding tradition. I mean, if you look at, for example, Chinese people from China, they're strongly influenced by the filial piety model that was created by Lao Tzu and Confucius from the Analects. And, you know, a lot of these people are Christians too. So it's not like, you know, they necessarily believe in everything on that, but at the very least they're grounded in that. And that the tradition across East Asia, that China produced from that heavily emphasized education and meritocracy, two things. Confucius was actually one of the first progenitors of the nuclear family model, where the husband was the caretaker. You know, the husband was the provider and the wife was the caretaker. And there was a filial order model. So a lot of the family values that is organized, you know, comes from that system of thought as well. So there's some heavy reliance upon this old culture that comes from, you know, the Confucian system.
And there's also, they were oppressed by communism, or they know what it's like to be oppressed. And you called that, I think you said, well, there's an identity politics associated with that. I never, this is my own ignorance here, but I never really associated communism with identity politics. Can you explain how the two go together?
I think your listeners need to understand, or should understand, what Maoism is specifically, the Maoist form of communism. So Stalin and Soviet communism was based on class, and it was based on the proletariat being oppressed by a wealthy bourgeoisie who controlled the means of production. It's more of a European model. Asian communism is a little bit different. Mao, especially, is influenced by Mao. Mao was very influential in this. Mao was a philosopher. He had a very philosophical understanding of communism. In his book On Practice and Contradiction, he wrote that there can be no oppressed without the oppressor. There can be no white without black. He believed in the metaphysical underpinning of communism, which is the division, which is division. And so when he got into power and he created the Cultural Revolution, he sought to divide on a number of different fronts. Not just between the landowners and not just between the haves and the have-nots, but everybody who was even on family lines, you know, the families that came from communist blood got preferential treatment. The families who came from rightist or nationalist blood, in his opinion, the intellectuals were considered to be menaces to society because they place too much value on their own individual effort rather than clinging into the communist spirit. Those who didn't sufficiently worship Mao, you know, were put into these classes. There were red and black classes. The red classes were the good classes. The black classes were the bad ones. And the ones who were bad, you know, could face torture, execution, everything like that. So the use of various identity categories to ultimately oppress and divide society, which is identity politics, is the root of this Maoist form of communism.
Wow. How many Asian Americans are there in the United States right now?
I think last checked, it was about 7% of America, which is about 330 million, 7%, probably about like 21 million.
And how can you summarize, like socioeconomically, that's a pretty big group, but by and large, you know, where are Asians in America compared to other groups?
California, New York, but there's a huge diaspora of Asian Americans
Oh,
in America.
No, I meant not where they are geographically, but where they are in terms of socioeconomic status and achievement.
Sure. So in my book, An Inconvenient Minority, I make this little graph of various different Asian or country of origins and sort of what percentage of them are on SNAP, which is like a poverty rate, an average income rate. So the lowest poverty rates are Chinese, Vietnamese, and to an extent Japanese and Indian. And the highest ones are Laotian, Cambodian, Hmong. But, you know, I use that, I say that because some people, for example, there's a common criticism on the left where they say that, no, you can't say Asian Americans are typically, you know, successful because of their culture in America, because there's so much inequality among Asian Americans. But if you look at where the inequality comes from, the ones that have that are the highest poverty rates, there's a very simple explanation. The reason why they have the highest poverty rates is because they came to this country later. Like the Hmong, the Cambodians, they came in like the early 2000s. Most of them came very recently. So when you come very recently, you're likely to be impoverished. I mean, my mom and dad, when they came from China in 1990, didn't have much money at all. They would definitely be considered in poverty, and they didn't get out of so-called poverty, the poverty line, until probably when they had me, which was like 1997, 1998. So it doesn't mean that even though they're below the poverty line, they don't experience the cultural deleterious effects of poverty as much as other groups do, because they have strong cultures of excellence. And so if the American experiment works as it has for Asians before, I would imagine these Laotian and Hmong and these newer immigrant Asian groups will come along just fine.
Now, by the way, Inconvenient Minority and the observations here, while spot on and you have data to back it up, I'm guessing they do make people uncomfortable, some people, especially on the left, because if these problems are cultural, certain groups would have to kind of reevaluate, how they're living and the decisions that are being made. And that makes people very uncomfortable. And I would imagine that you get pushback. They kind of don't want to hear about any of this because right away it goes to how people are living their lives, how they're choosing to live their lives. And that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, let's just address the elephant in the room here. I think the left is uncomfortable because it puts a spotlight on Black Americans and what's going on in Black America, for example, and why there are inequities inside Black Americans. And the reality is it is a combination of policy, culture, and potentially some discrimination and racism. But the problem is the left puts so much onus on the racism narrative that they ignore other inconvenient facts. For example, Black Americans that pass military exams and go into the military end up with much stronger career success and actually have career success on par with white Americans in many cases. Black Americans who have two-parent family structures have 97-98% chance of not being in poverty and everything like that. Another thing that you need to understand is that on average, Black Americans do study fewer hours per week. These are just facts. I mean, I'm just saying facts. You know, there's fewer hours per week than white Americans and Asian Americans. The average Asian American studies 13 hours a week. The average white studies 7 or 8. The average Black American studies 5, I think. And there's great variation in that. So for people to say, no, it's just racism, it's just discrimination, it's a very it's a very poor thing to say. It's because it's very, it masks true problems. And how are you going to be able to solve problems in society if you don't talk about true problems? You know, and so for me, you know, I say this with voices of empathy, but you have to talk about culture. You can't get better at the racial discourse unless you talk about culture.
By the way, is that census data, that those numbers on homework? How do we know that? Which, by the way, it all, you know, quite frankly, it, you know, it rings true. But how do we know that?
Sure. I will. There are various studies that, like, I can definitely. There is a survey. I mean, many different sample sizes surveys that I can send you.
So let me ask you this. Where are we right now? Anti-Asian hate is discussed. We see episodes of it on the news. Is it truly on the rise right now? And if it is, what do you attribute it to?
Anti-Asian hate?
Hate crimes, I should say.
Hate crimes. I think that crimes against Asians are on the rise. But crimes against every group are on the rise right now. During 2020, crime went up significantly for every group. Now, hate crimes went up for Asians, like, I think 150%. But the reason why is a combination of increased crimes against Asians and also the fact that more Asians started reporting hate crimes. You know, when a hate crime has to be reported as such, or it has to be litigated as such. And the reason why you would litigate a hate crime specifically and call it a hate crime is because you could get extra civil benefits from that. So there wasn't as much awareness about what a hate crime was, but I think during this whole Stop Asian Hate movement, you know, people saw crimes that were committed against them or their neighbors or something, and they interpreted it more as hate crimes than they did before.
Okay, so, but you say you think, I mean, is it overblown, perhaps? A crime increased across the board, yes. But you said 150%, but some of that is just reporting. I mean, if you look at the news, it would seem like it's, you know, almost an organized campaign. Is that overstated?
In terms of an organized campaign, yeah, that's overstated. There's no evidence to suggest there's an organized, targeted campaign against Asians. There's no evidence to suggest that this is something like that gangs have targeted Asians for. I definitely think there's still resentment between poor Asian Americans and, you know, in inner cities and other poor inner city groups such as poor Black Americans in Los Angeles. There's still lingering fears of that, but I don't think you can spin a nationwide narrative to the extent that it should be that's being portrayed right now.
And how are you with how Asians are portrayed in popular culture? How are you with that? Now I'm struggling right now to, you know, recall anything. I do think this is a sore point with some Asian Americans that I know. But I'm not sure, you know, that the Asian, you know, the stereotypical portrayal of an Asian in the movies or on television, was there a problem? Is there a problem? Has it changed? Has it improved? You know, kind of with Black Lives Matter and everything else becoming, there's kind of a readjustment on all matters of race. I know that's a bit of a hodgepodge there, but what do you say about that?
Yeah. Asians in popular culture, that's a good question. I think that Asian Americans are ascending in popular culture, perhaps to a place where they are going to be represented pretty well, I think, in popular culture. But there's no question that that Asian Americans were unfairly portrayed, you know, over the past few decades in some movies, like, 16 Candles or something like that. We all know about Long Duk Dong, right? The Donger, right? I mean, look, I look back on it and like I cringe a little bit, but it's still also funny to me because I'm not as anxious about my racial identity as other Asians perhaps are. But I appreciate the fact that there are some genuinely good movies by Asians that are being recognized, like Parasite, which was a great movie, and that more Asians are developing into strong actors. But you also have to remember, like, part of the reason why there wasn't much Asian representation in the media is because Asians were just not encouraged to go into those spaces by their own parents, right? You're an immigrant parent, your kid, you're just getting out of poverty. You're trying to build some generational wealth. Do you really think you're going to want to encourage your kid to become an actor, or a musician? No, that's not the path that you necessarily want your kid to go. You want your kid to go and be a doctor, everything like that. And I think Asians are finally accumulating enough. The word is confidence, cultural confidence, to really go and step into these industries. And I think they will do well.
Kenny, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, for 13 years of my life. Went to the governor's school there. And then I moved to New Jersey when I was 15 years old. I lived there for 3 years, and I went to Davidson in North Carolina. Spent some time there, spent some time in D.C. Now I'm back in North Carolina.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have two younger sisters, yeah.
And what do your parents do?
My dad works for a bank. My mom is an accountant.
Why did you go to Davidson College? By the way, is that where, did Woodrow Wilson have a role there?
Yeah, he did. He did. That's interesting. First one out of your head is Woodrow Wilson. Most people say Steph Curry. But Woodrow Wilson went to Davidson, yeah. For like a year. Then he transferred to Princeton.
What did you major in?
I majored in math.
And would you call yourself a political person? Are you political at this point?
Am I political? Yeah, I'm definitely political. I mean, I'm a political commentator now. I'm in this space. I think that we need more heterodox voices in the racial discourse. I'm not even going to say necessarily conservative. I'm just going to say heterodox. The race narrative has been dominated by one group, the left, for far too long, and as a result, the quality of their ideas has diminished. You've seen this with Nicole Hannah-Jones, the 1619 Project, which is very low quality from the perspective of merit, base of history, that exaggerates, that does not synthesize well. There needs to be more competition. I would say I'm on the political front.
And growing up, was there a moment or like an episode that occurred and that politicized you or where you found yourself moving in that direction?
I think growing up, I always had a passion for what I believed in. Starting out, it was me being a Christian. I went to a pretty secular school, and I had to basically defend my faith against like relentless attacks from all kinds of angles. So for me, politics, and I understand why America needs politics, but for me, politics is secondary to what my faith is and what I care about. And so for me, since it's not even the highest thing that I'm aspiring to be, it's something that, it doesn't scare me as much.
And can I ask you that? That's interesting. You were being approached, you were being kind of hassled about your faith from many sides. How did that happen? I mean, I happen to be a Christian myself, and I was baptized, but my faith has become much more important to me over the past couple of years. And as I look back, I'm just surprised how little discussion there was about faith. And I went to public schools. It just almost never came up. Were you bringing it up? Were you preaching the gospel, which I would applaud you for doing? But I'm surprised to hear that you were kind of in some way persecuted for your beliefs.
Yeah, I was talking to my friends about Christianity. That's why. I became a Christian probably when I was in sixth, seventh grade. And, you know, for a while I was kind of an angry Christian too. Like, I was pretty angry at the world because it seemed like people didn't believe what I believed. And I was angry about that. I've obviously since moderated on that front. But I haven't lost the fervor. And I think that, you know, what happened was, well, I would start talking about it, and then people would little poke some ideas, and I developed a little reputation at my school. And then, you know, people started coming to me with questions, some sincere, some not, some made in good faith, some not. And I became a little bit of a lightning rod. And I've always just kind of been a lightning rod person. I think when I was in college, I was also a lightning rod because I was like a voice speaking out about certain issues on free speech and intellectual diversity. But by the way, Greg, this does bring me back to one point about how I got so involved with like identity politics specifically. Another reason why I got involved with identity politics is because I hate the fact, I really hate it, that the first thing that a lot of people think of when they think of people will look at a minority or a person who looks visibly different and think that they must have certain beliefs, they must have certain views, and more importantly, that person even like really cares about the color of his skin. You know, I had struggles with the color of my skin. I had struggles with the fact that I was an Asian American, and it took me a little while to recover from that. And now ultimately it's maybe like the sixth or seventh most important thing about me from an identity perspective. But for me, there's so much more to me that I place a lot more value in, such as my faith, such as, you know, the fact that I'm a North Carolinian, such as the fact that I'm an American and I'm a conservative, than the fact that I'm an Asian American. I'm not saying I'll place any value in it, but that's one thing I wanted to do with the advocacy that I'm doing, is help people to see a little more nuance in the way that minorities are really just people who just want to be treated like everyone else.
Forgive me, but how old are you?
I'm 24.
And your full-time job, is this a full-time occupation for you?
Yes, it's a full-time occupation for me. I am president of Color Rush United. I'm the lead fundraiser. I'm the lead spokesman. We do have another spokesman. His name is Christian Watson. He's also really great. He's a philosopher, a black commentator. He's great. But yes, you know, this is the, and I am. You know, and I'm also a full-time author. So yeah, this is my full-time profession.
And is there an end state? Is there a tangible goal that you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, I would like the instantiation of a colorblind society in America. I really would like it where Americans and every ordinary Americans, and I think we were all already on the path towards this before this CRT and before all of this wokeness, but I want an America where people will genuinely look at each other for the content of their character, not the color of their skin. Treat people like individuals, get to know people's stories. If a person wants to talk about his racial background, fine, let them. That's a part of their identity. But if a person doesn't care, stop making them feel like they should care, you know? That's what I want. And I think that's the ideal that I'm striving for. I think that's a Christian ideal. It's also an American ideal, meritocracy, right? The American dream the dream that all immigrants aspire to, which is you come to this country, you escape persecution many times, and you come to this country and you just want to be treated on the basis of what you can offer, not on the basis of your background.
Two quick observations I just want to run by you. When I was in
Yeah.
school, it was overwhelmingly white. I grew up in the suburbs. First town was a bit more diverse. I moved when I was in second grade. There were a handful of Asian students, Asian American students, and they were, I say they, that sounds not kind right there, but I don't think we ever. I don't think anyone viewed them as Asian American or anything. They were completely socialized in every respect. I don't, you know, we didn't,
Huh.
it was, I don't know if we were unique or whatever. Number one, yes, I mean, they were high achieving, but they were totally with it, and it was just unremarked upon their what they looked like. I don't think I grew up in some sort of utopia, but that is my experience. And the other thing that I just want to run by you is I have been, well, everybody's been kind of persecuted or tormented at one point, you know, be it a boss or colleagues or, you know, whatever. And everybody I ever had a bad relationship with, say at school or at work, was white and Christian. The idea that we're kind of you know, monolithic, and we're looking out for each other based on race is kind of silly. Anyway, anything you want to say about that, particularly the first part? I mean, is that unique? Does that sound strange?
No, I mean, so here's the thing. Minorities, especially in those situations, they do have anxieties, right? You're one of three Asians in a 300 person school. Well, yeah, I mean, when you get rejected, when somebody treats you wrongly, you have a tendency to put it on your race. I don't think that should be surprising. That doesn't surprise me that there's racial anxiety in this country. What's starting to surprise me, and this is like a critical nuance, but what's starting to surprise me is that people are starting to say, because you're a different race, you and I cannot have the same experience. Like, you fundamentally do not understand my experience as a black person or my experience as an Asian person because you're white. I don't believe that's true. I think that that's false. Because even if you are actually discriminated on the basis of your race, think about what that looks like. That means you're applying for a job or you're applying for a school or something, and somebody says, I don't like you. And they shut the door in your face and say it's because that person is a racist. Well, that is an experience that is shared by people of all races. Everybody can empathize, and the correct response to that should be empathy. It shouldn't be self-abnegation saying, oh my gosh, I have no capability of understanding your experience. No, you do. You do, because it's an experience of rejection that everyone can face. I mean, when I was trying to get out my first book before I had any success whatsoever, I got the door slammed in my face 50, 60 times by 50, 60 different agents, And the proper response to that isn't, oh, woe is me, I'm discriminated against because I'm Asian. The proper response to that is moving on to the next one, because thank God we live in a country where you are, I guess, thank God we live in a country where the primary way of people telling you that they don't like you is by telling you no instead of doing something far worse to you.
You mentioned the deleterious effects or the deleterious qualities, I guess, or of having a certain level of success. You know, when you're Asian and you've done this, that, and the other thing, and you have worked hard and you've achieved. I think you said something about the negatives that go with that. Did you? Did I get that right?
You did. You did.
What are they?
So the negatives is that you get there are people who resent you for your success. And I see this in the Harvard admissions case. I also see this in the Thomas Jefferson and Stuyvesant and SHSAT admissions cases. There are these liberals in these New York City, Arlington, Virginia, who are uncomfortable with the fact that Thomas Jefferson High School is 70% Asian. Thomas Jefferson is the school with the top math and science high school in the nation. Admissions is by merit.
I'm sorry,
And
where is
same
it?
thing in New York City,
Where's Thomas
where the
Jefferson?
it's in Arlington, Virginia.
Okay.
Stuyvesant High School is 70% Asian. Admissions into the Stuyvesant is only by a test. It's also widely considered the best school in New York City. People are uncomfortable by that. People don't like that. It sheds sort of, it makes them feel uncomfortable with the way that they have reared their own children. And I think there's a mix. I don't think that you should feel guilty because remember, Asian Americans coming without social connections have to rely on their merit to survive in this country. They don't come with like generational wealth that provides any kind of buffer. Like their priority is education. That's their strategy. Let them have their strategy of success. That's okay. I think that that's fine. If you want to pursue something else, if you want to pursue business success, sports success, art success, that's fine. Just don't deny the fruits of the success to a cultural group that wants to accomplish it in one way. But there is resentment. And I think that that resentment does rear itself in these Harvard admissions policies discriminating against Asians, in these proposals at Thomas Jefferson to change it to lottery admission systems. All of these proposals that you see on the table will lower the percentage of Asians at these schools. All of them.
And that seems to be the mission. That's exactly what they want. What is the latest on Stuyvesant, by the way? Which, by the way, I did not know was that high. It was 70%. I
Yeah,
know
it's 70.
70%. That's wild. I mean, it's a testament to the. Well, look. Let me. What is the latest? I think Eric Adams was campaigning. I think he made a promise to open it up. I heard he reversed himself. What's the latest on that?
So there's still a lot of political pressure on Eric Adams to reverse the test. Basically, right now, admissions to Stuyvesant is still solely by a test. Last time I checked, I don't think I'm wrong, but I could be. But there's still a lot of pressure on Adams to get rid of that and replace it with something else more holistic, that allows for more diversity, which is a code word for gets rid of those pesky Asians who are taking over the school system. But I don't know if he'll cave. Let's see if he does.
Can I ask you, what is the knock on Asians who achieve amazing things academically?
Yeah, the knock is that Asians are the word the care the phrase that I use is test taking robots with no personality. Basically, Asians are trained from birth to academically focus on success and get rid of, their good character traits in the process, or they're basically trained and weaned to be robots. And so the stereotype is that these Asians who are highly successful academically must be low personality, which is, by the way, exactly the stereotype that Harvard uses to denigrate Asians and force them to be admitted at lower rates. Asians score highest academically at Harvard, no surprise. They score highest in extracurriculars at Harvard, no surprise. They also score lowest on the personality score that Harvard uses, which is the determinant score to get into Harvard, actually. And it's no coincidence that they view Asians this way, because they think that the only way, the only reason, because in their minds, these Asians who are academically successful are also socially compromised. And they would not be able to be and represent Harvard as a so-called Harvard man that they envision themselves to be the gatekeepers and protectorates for.
And the personality judgment comes, I guess, obviously from the interview, right?
No, it doesn't. Actually, it doesn't. It comes from the admissions officer who has no interaction with the applicant. The alumni interviews actually universally give these Asian Americans the highest ranks among all the races. The teacher recommendations give Asians the highest and second highest ranks. It comes from the admissions officers, the ones who make the final call, who are supposed to use this information but end up denigrating these Asians.
That's kind of shocking. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Well, do me a favor. Can you just briefly tell us a little bit about the Harvard case? I thought Harvard won the first round. Is that true?
So Harvard won the first round. They also won the second round, but it has been appealed to the Supreme Court. And in January 2022, just a couple months ago, the Supreme Court authorized the Harvard case to be argued in front of them. And this is, and it was, I think we're going to win at the Supreme Court. I genuinely do. I don't think they would have done that unless there was a passionate cadre of Supreme Court justices who really wanted, who really saw a real issue with the way that these admissions practices are discriminating against Asians.
And I know we just kind of talked about it, but do me a favor. Can you recap the situation? Who's suing who? And take us through the history of the Harvard case, please.
Students for Fair Admissions is the group suing Harvard. They're a group made out of Asian Americans who applied to Harvard and who got rejected or waitlisted from Harvard, despite the fact that they have these much higher SAT scores, higher grades, strong extracurricular development, etc. So they're the group that's suing Harvard. Harvard has responded by saying, no, we're just using races as like one factor among many, many factors, and they're consistent with Supreme Court precedent. The data has been uncovered. No, Harvard is not using race as just one factor, but race is pretty much predominant throughout the Harvard admission system. Asians have been kept to between 15 and 20% of the class for the past 30 years. You might think that that's still overrepresented given the population, but it's actually severely underrepresented given the top achieving population in America. Asians make up about 55% of the top SAT scores in the country, but they're getting into Harvard at between 15 and 20%. They're also lowest in the personality score. I think that Students for Fair Admissions is a really strong case.
Given the what you said about studying and the work ethic and the lack of social connections upon arrival here in America, and I'm talking stereotypes here, and you mentioned what one of them is about, just totally focus on the test. I mean, has there been any kernel of? I mean, I assume there's a kernel of truth, one might say, in all stereotypes. Is there anything to that? I mean, and forgive me for asking. I mean, you just dispelled that by saying, well, look, they're obviously, these recommendations are effusive and they're involved in all these electives and things like that. But is it something that the community is aware of and is trying to fight against this perception and that there might be something to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the community has become made a much more aware of it over the past 5 years. And to that, I credit the efforts of Students for Fair Admissions. I also did my part. I wrote the book An Inconvenient Minority, which became an Amazon bestseller last year. So that was huge. Yes, I mean, Asian Americans at this point, I think, are very well aware of the Harvard case. I think it is a near universal understanding about this case among Asian Americans. They have many different opinions of it, but I think nearly anyone educated enough to get into college probably understands this.
I guess no, what I was saying, yes, but the whole idea that There's the stereotype that you mentioned,
Oh, yeah.
and that, okay, this is something we have to work on as a group because we're not as a group, but look, if you're studying so much, there almost by definition will be less time to do this, that, and the other thing. Like you said, there's less encouragement to join the arts because you got to focus on the basics. And so, is there anything to that? I noticed you kind of you appropriately scoffed at that notion, but it persists. And what do you make of that, the idea that it does persist?
This is what I make of it. I don't actually think that your test score has any correlation, negative or positive, with your so-called personality. I don't think that getting a higher score means you have a better personality. I don't think that getting a lower score means you have a worse personality or a better personality. I think that the problem is that the stereotype on Asia is against Asian Americans because there's an incentive to stereotype against Asian Americans because you can keep this policy alive that depresses Asian Americans at these admissions processes. And so this is why it's continuing to be attributed to Asian Americans. I mean, you consider like Asian Americans test-taking robots with no personality, but at least they're scoring really high on the test. I mean, what about all of these other Americans of different races? Like, do you think they have great personalities because they score low on the test? That doesn't seem intuitive to me. I think that they're completely independent. But the stereotype against Asians is because there's a political incentive to stereotype Asians in this way. It's because there's a policy that some liberals want to keep in place that depresses Asian turnout, allows for more wealthy, well-connected people of other races to get in at the expense of those who genuinely outperform them in objective metrics. So what's really happening is it's the cadre of people who are anxious about their own kid getting into these prestigious colleges, and whites, blacks, even other Asians, who because of that anxiety try to blame another group for it and try to do everything that they can or to try to do what they can to try to undermine the other side.
Amazing. No, totally brilliant, man. Let me just ask you a couple of quick questions as we wrap up. How do you spend your day? How do you spend your what is most of your time focused on?
So what's most of my time focused on? How do I spend my day?
Is it like raising money, or is it what?
Well, I go, I mean, I, so I do, I run Colorist United. We fight, we fight for a race-blind America. We fight corporations and nonprofits who've been going woke. We fight CRT in schools. We organize. So that takes up a lot of my day. But then, after I go to the gym and everything like that, I'm writing my book, or I'm continuing to write. I'm doing journalism articles. You see me periodically publish in places like, The Spectator, Newsweek, USA Today, even the Wall Street Journal occasionally. I have a social life, I promise. I go to church and everything like that.
Have you thought about politics? Have you thought about running for something someday?
Yeah, I thought, of course. I mean, if you're in this space, you always think, well, can I go run? But I've determined that now is not my time to run.
And you mentioned you became a Christian when you were in sixth grade. Do you read the Bible? And for anyone on the fence about Christianity, because the world is always telling them that that they're always focusing on what they perceive to be the negatives and this and that, Could you just talk a little bit about your faith and what it's done for you and what it could do for others?
I think for me, the most powerful thing that I get from my faith is that I get a sense of worth that isn't tied to, I get a sense of self-worth that I know is true, that isn't tied to me being successful in whatever the world's eyes are. You know, part of the people always say all the time, don't you think meritocracy is a little harsh? Well, it is actually a little harsh if you put all of your inherent value on the work and success, the worldly success that you produce. But because I know that the truth is that you're not ultimately judged on your worldly success, the treasures that you store on earth, but you're judged on the treasures that you store in heaven, I'm not concerned about, you know, my own self-worth dependent upon my success or failure, because I know that God ultimately, you know, the question of your own worth is determined by Christ's death and resurrection. It's actually determined by God, who loves unconditionally. And so for me, Christianity is a very freeing understanding, and I'm really, really grateful even more because it's true. It's not just a lie. It's based on historical fact. It's based on the resurrection of Jesus, and it's based on the testimony of millions, including my own testimony, you know, me going through struggles with popularity, me going through struggles with all of that. So that's my testimony.
Wasn't he great? What a thoughtful guy. Could be president someday. Look for him on social media, Kenny Xu. That's Xu, X-U, and his book, which I have just purchased myself, and it is called An Inconvenient Minority, The Attack on Asian American Excellence and the Fight for Meritocracy. Next week, I may have my daughter make an appearance. She's only 2 years old. That'll be interesting. Thank you all. To be continued.